Thank you, Lily. I don't know if I should feel special. I got my own introduction, or if I should feel that I'm forgettable because he just forgot I was here. Either way, I have a depressing thought to share with you. It is day 5, which means we're halfway through the week. And for those who have done this often, you know the second half of the week goes much faster than the first half. So, get anything you needed to do, get done fast, because next thing you know, we'll be going home. And I know we've had some sound issues, so if the mic drops out, all I can say is come closer, because I don't have the voice to fill this room all by myself unaided. There are advantages and disadvantages to living in our modern age. And I know, like most of us, we had our share of trials, if you want to say, or frustrations trying to get to the feast this year. I know many people who've had cars that have broken down, reservations that have not turned out like we thought. But I can only think of way back when people had to take everything they had or everything they were traveling with and load it on a donkey and then walk for a week. And they didn't have a phone to call for the reservation. They had to hope that there was space for them at the inn, that there was an inn when they got there. And when they got there, maybe they would take a hatchet, cut off some limbs, and build themselves a shack. So, hey, we can complain, but I do wonder if we lose some of the benefits of the experience at times, because easier isn't always better. But this situation is something I have felt with my favorite hobby. And I know, I think it was Bill who mentioned it as well, but if you know me well, I enjoy astronomy. And from the time I was a teenager, I've had a telescope, I've looked in the sky. But the hobby of astronomy has evolved a great deal just from the time I started. I started out, like I said, as a teenager, simple scope. Something my parents bought me, really cheap. Then I got a job, and then I got money, and then I could buy my own equipment. And I think there's a pic up there of some of what I have collected over the years, and it's in the daytime, you've noticed. It's hard to take a picture of your telescopes at night because it's so dark. This was actually during the eclipse in 2017. But I can't help but think, what would Galileo do with my telescopes? Or Newton, or Kepler? The giants who made the great discoveries that helped us understand the universe. What I have is just so completely superior to theirs, just because of our modern technology, our ability to build and grind optics, and to make them so cheaply that on a meager budget, anyone can buy them. And then you can buy them with a GPS attachment, so you don't even have to align them. You can just set them up, turn them on, they'll connect to a satellite, figure out exactly where they are around the globe. They have all the star charts in their memory. You touch a button, it goes and shows you whatever you want. And you can be lazier than that. If you have Wi-Fi, you just sit in your house in the comfort of your own room, open your computer, connect your telescope, and watch everything everything that your telescope can see can get right to your computer. And if you're too lazy, you can just buy a subscription and connect to some telescope that's in the middle of the Pacific Ocean and see what they're looking at. But I do wonder if we lose some of the benefits of the experience. Because when I learned it, it was me and a telescope, and I got out into a field in the middle of the night, and I figured out all the angles in my latitude. And it was frustrating, but it was exciting, because there is a downside to modern technology. Anyone who's walked outside of their suburban home knows this, because you look up in the sky and what do you see? Maybe 5-6 stars. It's unfortunate, but with our light pollution, we don't really see the sky very much anymore. And with the internet, wonderful as it is, we are spoiled with such amazing pictures. Pictures that you can't even see normally if you have a visual scope to look. They've been processed so much, and they've been taken through telescopes that are so huge, and we get so used to them. Here's an experience that I had that was very frustrating. I waited 2 years for Mars to get into the right alignment. And if you're familiar with this, Earth and Mars align about every 2 years where you can actually get a good view through a telescope. So here I do. I set up my telescope, get the right time, the sky is clear. And I find it, and I look at it, and if you kind of If you look just right, you can see some of the different shadings and maybe even see some of the polar ice cap, and you're excited. This is pretty cool. And you go to your friend and say, look at this. And then he pulls out a cell phone, takes a couple swipes, and gives you this. How do you compare? How do you compare? There is one object in the sky, though, that always delivers. There is one object that we take for granted. And it's something you've seen every night, most every night you go outside, and you don't even think of it sometimes when you think of astronomy, but you look in the sky and you see this big full moon. That's not it. You can jump ahead a couple. That's an empty, there you go. That's the big full moon. If you've ever seen it through a telescope, it looks very different. It's simple, and yet it's breathtaking. Once you look in and see all the different craters. In fact, when the great thing about the moon is that it shows us the same face, but the sun hits it. The face that faces the sun changes as it rotates around the Earth, so you actually see a different angle. The sun's light hits the moon at different angles throughout its phases, and so you actually get a different viewing effect as the moon goes through its phases. And when you look at it close up in magnification, you see the craters, you see the mountains. In fact, and there's one pic in here where you can see the shadows. This is a comparison of a couple days apart, and you can just see how the light hits at a different angle. You get so many different details. You see the depth of it. There is a dynamic relationship that the Earth has with the moon. It's the largest natural satellite in relation to the size of the planet in the solar system. Something special about us. Compared to our size, it's bigger than any other natural satellite. It has stabilized our orbit. It has slowed us down. We have a 24-hour day because the moon is there instead of a 6-hour day. Slowed our rotation. It has kept us from, while you ever take a top and spin it on a table and you see how it moves around and it kind of spins? The Earth would do the same thing, except there's the moon with its influence, and it keeps us at our 23-degree angle. That means our seasons are stable and reliable. It stirs the oceans with its gravity. We have the tides. It initiates erosion. It helps minerals pull out of the bedrock into the water. It helped induce tectonic activity. It has become a timepiece for nature. If you're familiar with the circadian rhythms that we have, and that's with the sun, well, nature has rhythms with the moon. It's more than just a nightlight. It has stabilized our ecosystem, and geologists and biologists will tell us life couldn't exist as it is without having the moon there. Now, there is one sexy beast in our solar system. I've saved this for last, because if ever I'm out observing and I have a smart aleck with me, this one always silences them. This is Saturn. It never fails to impress. It is just so intricate. It is so beautiful. It just hangs there in the sky. And I don't care if you see it in a high-def picture from Hubble, or even if you do look at it through your little telescope, it's still, you just can't look at it and not wonder. What keeps that system together? You know, those are trillions upon trillions of tiny ice and dust grain particles all revolving around that planet. And it does so in such an orderly fashion. It looks like a record. It looks like an old vinyl phonograph record when you get up close. We've sent probes into it to take close-up pictures of it, and it's mesmerizing when you look at it. Not only have we sent probes to look at it, we've sent probes to go through it. And we have found some interesting things, because when we've asked ourselves, why is it still there? Why hasn't it dissipated? Why hasn't it fallen apart? Is it just that young? Well, we have a short little video I'd like to show you. And we have discovered there's two moons on one of the outer rings. One is named Pandora, the other is named Prometheus. And if you look really close as that one moon is moving, you see the ripples in that ring? You see the kind of little fluctuations in the way that it... Sorry, our video is flickering. The gravity of that moon actually pulls the particles out of their orbit. And it's, you look at that and think, well, how come the whole thing just isn't just big one jumbled mess? But as they watch, they realize it's not just pulling it out. It's pulling. It's pushing. Here's actually a video from, this is the Cassini spacecraft. And if you are get dizzy easily, you may want to close your eyes because this whole, you're going to see it all twist and turn. But this tiny little moon moves with inside those rings, and it pushes, it pulls, it tugs, and it actually keeps all those particles in line, in their orbit. So all those fine little rings get maintained, all from a tiny moon that you would think would throw everything out of whack. A system that complex maintains its order all by itself. And that's something that you just kind of have to sit back and go, wow. The natural world isn't the only place we find such self-correcting mechanisms. And that's where mostly I'm going to go today. In 1776, the economist and philosopher Adam Smith, he published a book called The Inquiry into the Nature and Causes of the Wealth of Nations. And that was a day when the titles of books actually told you what was in the book, and not just a headline to try to get you to buy it. But he had a revolutionary idea, and that was, when people engage in trade, if they are free to do so, to make their own choices, that the market regulates itself. There is no need for any external interference. And this was a little bit mind-blowing at the time. This was a bit radical, as at the time they're trying to figure out, how do you design governments, how do you design economies for the better of everyone? And he said, basically, leave it alone. There is no need for external interference. In fact, he coined the term, there's an unseen hand that guides it. And we are familiar with certain natural laws, such as supply and demand. We kind of learned this in high school economics. And it's a little counterintuitive. But when people engage in trade with their own self-interest in mind, it all tends to balance each other out. There's an equilibrium that's reached, where the producer is trying to produce, he's pursuing the highest profit, the consumer is seeking the best value, and when they're all free to do this, it all tends to work. It self-organizes. In our world, we have a lot of complex systems, social systems, political systems, economic systems. What maintain their order? What keeps this all from falling into chaos? Now, I'm going to give you three things to consider, and I'm sure that there are more, but these are the three that I've come up today. Considering, how does our society, how does our culture maintain its structure, maintain its order without falling apart? Number one, we're all familiar with the proverb, train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. These are good, old-fashioned values, aren't they? Raise your kids right. Teach them what to do, what is right, what is wrong. Work hard, respect others, love God, obey the rules. Teach them right, and everything will turn out okay. Now, of course, we kind of know the reality of it, don't we? You train up a child in the way he should go, then you send him off to college, where he learns to betray every value you have ever taught him. But this is good old common sense. Impressed with someone, good values, good habits, and it will lead to a good life. And that's the role that the family plays. You have a mother and father who model what good behavior is, what adults should look like, what responsible behavior looks like. Siblings teach us how to socialize and work with each other. And aunts and uncles and grandparents and cousins, they're that support group that help us get through, teach us things, pull us out of the fire, give us the support we need. This all sounds like common sense, and for the most part, it is. But I want to add one more ingredient to it. I want you to want to read from Psalm 78. And one more perspective. It says, listen, verse 1, O my people, to my instruction. Incline your ears to the words of my mouth, and I will open my mouth in a parable. I will utter dark sayings of old, which we have heard and known, and our fathers have told us. We will not conceal them from their children, but tell them to the generation to come the praises of the Lord and his strength and his wondrous works that he has done. For he established a testimony in Jacob, and he appointed a law in Israel, which he commanded our fathers that they should teach them to their children, that the generation to come might know, even the children yet to be born, that they may arise and tell them to their children, that they should put their confidence in God and not forget the works of God, but keep His commandments. The responsibility of every generation to pass down their legacy, where they came from, where they're going, it's not just a parent-child relationship. This is a grandparent to parent to child to grandchild. This is over many generations. It takes more than one generation to see the influence of God in their lives and in their peoples and in their histories. It's a long-term vision of what God is doing. And a lot of issues that we're dealing with today, marriage, gender roles, these are things that from a single generation perspective, they don't lead us to happiness. That's not their purpose. They're there to give us stability. And you have to look upon 3 and 4 and 5 and sometimes 10 generations to see how some of these structures that we have help keep us safe and keep us stable. The message passed down, God has a plan. He's working that plan. He has revealed a way to live that will bring us peace and prosperity. And if we stray from that way, all of those blessings we desire will not be achieved. Second point, I had a history teacher. He was very fond of this historian, and he kind of impressed it in me, and so I end up quoting him a lot. But there's a French historian and social observer, Alexis de Tocqueville. He published a book in 1835, a long time ago, called Democracy in America. It's a great book. It's about that thick. So if you enjoy history, read it. Otherwise, steer clear. His insights, though, are numerous and profound. But he had a very interesting perspective. He was French. If you know French history, they had their own revolution. They had their own push for liberty. They threw out their king, and it did not go very well for them. After a few years of what they called the Reign of Terror, eventually ended up with an emperor that came out in a worse place than when they started. So he wanted to know, how did this work in a ragtag group of colonies? How did they make this liberty work amongst them? Because there is this tension, part of the discussion of the time. Republics don't last long because they walk a tightrope. You stray too far down one path and you end up with anarchy. You stray too far to the other side, you end up with tyranny. It's very hard to keep that balance correct. If you stick to your own interests, I'm free, I have my cabin out in the woods, nobody touch me, you isolate yourself. You disconnect yourself from everyone else. You lose touch with your community. And you don't notice the chaos until it's too late. But if we try to engineer society, we stick our nose in everyone's business, we become over-involved. And then we become an authority to them. We become a tyrant. He had a lot of insights, but there's one I want to give to you. There's something, an ingredient, what he called civil associations. He said this is something that was prevalent within the United States. They're basically small groups that people get involved with for the betterment or improvement of society. And I'm going to throw out a couple modern examples. The Boy Scouts, the Rotary Club, the Peace Corps, Little League Baseball. People just getting together, working, throwing the resources to do something that's good for the community. They were voluntary, which means we got to pursue our own passions, our own interests. We had our personal freedom and liberty intact. But they kept us connected with the community and its needs. That's how we maintained liberty for all. Now, can you guess what the most influential of these civil associations were? They were churches. Something that set America apart from almost every other nation. Not only was there a church on every corner, there was at least two on each corner. We had them in number. They were big. They were small. They were conservative. They were liberal. They were a part of organizations and denominations that spanned the globe. And they were a part of denominations that were entirely local and found nowhere else in the world. They were flexible enough to adjust to the changing needs of societies. And most of our great movements in our country started in our churches. The Great Awakening of Prohibition, Universal Suffrage, the Abolitionist Movement, Civil Rights Movement, you go down it. When our culture changed, it was in the churches where it started. And for the third point, I want to quote some things from their founding fathers had said. John Adams once said that our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other. Benjamin Franklin, only a virtuous people are capable of freedom. As nations become corrupt and vicious, they have more need of masters. There was an understanding that a collective moral character of a people was more important than the form that that government took. You don't have to be righteous, but you do have to have a moral compass. You do need to know right from wrong. Now, have you ever asked yourself or been in that conversation of what form of government will be in the kingdom of God? How will it structure itself? You can get some really good ones. Is it going to be a monarchy? We have a king. Is it going to be a constitutional republic? We're going to have a constitution. We're going to elect officials. We're going to have representatives. Is it just going to be a group of individual communities? And does it really matter? Because the one detail we're given, the one difference that it's going to be in that place, is that it's going to be governed by those who are filled with God's Spirit. People who will lead and not rule. It is the character of a people that determine its destiny more than anything else. So over the last few decades, what has happened to our families? What has happened to our churches? What has happened to our national virtue? Do I even need to go into that? Because I think we all know, we all feel it. Is it any wonder that our culture has devolved into chaos? The self-correcting mechanisms have been abandoned. They were there for a long time. We've slowly undermined all those. The things that kept us in balance have been turned upside down. And we are in a time of transition, and make no mistakes about it. Historians, political scientists, they all agree. This is nothing new. It happens every 40, 50 years or so. There's a cultural shift. The equilibrium has been broken. For the next few years, maybe a decade, it's going to be chaos. It's going to be fun. It's going to be scary. It's a brave new world because nobody knows how it's going to end. When I say that, there's going to be a new balance that is going to come out of it. But until it happens, all we can do is adapt or be left behind. Now, I want to look at one other time of transition in Scripture. This is the only other Scripture we'll go to today. In Luke chapter 3, we have kind of a little peek. And if you know the time frame, this was a time of cultural where the cultural balance had shifted. Political, social, religious turmoil was prevalent at the time that Christ came on this earth. And God sent a prophet. He sent a prophet to prepare the way for Jesus' arrival. And boy, did he stir things up. And in Luke 3, if you jump up a couple verses, you can see he tells them, "You brood of vipers, who warned you to flee from the wrath to come?" He told them to bear fruits keeping with repentance. He said, don't think that because Abraham is your father that you have any excuse. He said, the axe is laid at the root of the tree. And so people heard this. And this was appointed, this was sent to the religious. This was not to Rome. This was not to the sinners. This was to what they thought were the righteous people. So in verse 10, the crowds were questioning him, saying, then what shall we do? And that's a good question. It's a question many of us ask ourselves when we look out in the world around us. This is crazy. We know things are wrong. What should we do? Verse 11, he said, he'd answer, and he said, the man who has two tunics is to share with him who has none, and he who has food to do likewise. That doesn't seem like an answer fit for that question. That's kind of a very simple, basic Christianity. All right, well, then someone else stood up. Tax collectors also came to him, and they said, teacher, what shall we do? And he said, collect no more than what you have been ordered to. Soldiers were questioning him, saying, what about us? What shall we do? And he said, do not take money from anyone by force. Don't accuse anyone falsely. Be content with your wages. They seem a little underwhelming in their answers. It's not rocket science. These are the same things they've been told for generation upon generation. It's the same message that has been passed down. And that's the good news. It's not rocket science. Apply this to our times. So I'll throw out three things we can do. Again, should be no news to you. Strengthen our families. That is the core of our strength in our nation and in our own lives. It's the most important institution in our society. It's not there for our happiness. It's there for our stability. And I know it's hard. Strengthen our marriages. They're not going to fix themselves. It's the most important relationship you will have. And I know some might say our relationship with God is the most. Well, you know God reveals himself as a family. You know he relates to his church like a husband to a wife. This is where our faith is expressed in how we relate to one another. And if we can't get along, maybe our relationship with God isn't as strong as we think it is. But it is something we do need to work on. Number two, we need to build our churches. This is where we connect with our communities. This is where we interface with our culture, where we find the balance between our own personal liberties and our civic responsibility. And for many, the church becomes their surrogate family. And number three, live the virtuous life. Speak the truth, inwardly and outwardly. When you talk to others and when you look in your own heart, be truthful. Act justly. Do the right thing, no matter what it costs you. Be generous. Be kind. Be merciful. Be patient. Be the person you were called to be. These are all things we know, but these are things we don't always do so well. Who has the role of putting everything back into order? Boy, it feels like the weight of the world on our shoulders. It really isn't. We're told to do something very simple. Live our life like we were told to live it. When you look up in the sky and see the moon, and to understand, it stabilizes life on Earth just by its mere presence. It moves the waters, it maintains the seasons, it sheds light into darkness. It doesn't impose itself, it doesn't ask permission, it just is. It's just there. We've been told to preach the gospel at all times, and when necessary, use words. I love that quote, because it reminds us part of being a witness is what your life does and what people see when they look at you. Our lives have an impact by just being who we are, by being consistent, by being persistent. Sometimes we're not even noticed, but we change the world ever so slightly. A kind act, an encouraging word, an honest transaction. We push, we pull, we bring a little order to the chaos, calming the panic, healing the hurts, overlooking the faults, supplying love and hope and peace into a chaotic world. And like those little moons circling that wondrous world so far away, invisible to practically every eye, maintaining order, one speck of dust at a time.